And this hour, of course, we'll take your phone calls with Robert Sawyer as we talk about his work, science fiction, and the Oppenheimer alternative. A few more questions, and then we'll get to your calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. George Norrie with you. Robert Sawyer with us. We're talking about all kinds of incredible things with science fiction and also his latest book, The Oppenheimer Alternative. Now, the catcher, Mo Berg, he last played with the Boston Red Sox, basically was a spy for us, wasn't he?
That's right. And, of course, a lot of people had dual existences in wartime, and he happened to be a spy, and he went to listen to Werner Heisenberg and was prepared to assassinate him as if that was felt to be necessary to put an end to the atomic bomb program. There are those who think that Heisenberg threw a monkey wrench into the work, just, you know, slowed it down. He was, without question, a patriotic German, and it's perfectly possible to be a patriot and also be at odds with the head of your state. That might resonate with some people who are listening at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, and he was a patriotic German who felt that Germany was his home and his country, but he could not abide the notion that Adolf Hitler would have this weapon. So he may have, we'll never know, he's dead, but he may have thrown the game. He may have deliberately delayed Germany being able to get that weapon.
I think he died in 76 in Munich. So after the war, did anybody use him for his abilities?
He was certainly employed. Oh, yeah, he was employed as a physicist, as a physics professor. But he wasn't, I don't believe anybody was using him to make bombs anymore
right.
At that point.
Well, why didn't we take him like we did with Wernher von Braun and those folks?
So he was taken to Farm Hall. He was, the Manhattan Project, we think of it as an American project. It was actually three nations, the United States, Great Britain, and Canada. In fact, the Brits started the nuclear bomb effort before the United States. Their effort was called Tube Alloys, just a code name, Tube Alloys. And Heisenberg ultimately ended up being left with the Brits and repatriated to Germany after the fact.
Do the Brits even have a space program? I don't think they do.
Currently, they do not. They do not.
I don't think they've ever launched a rocket, have they?
They have never launched a rocket into space. They've done missile tests and so forth, and they are, lest us forget, they are a nuclear power. So they do certainly have intercontinental ballistic missiles. But no, they are not a spacefaring nation.
And they have their submarines with nukes, don't they?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
That's the big deterrent right about now. Well, of everything you have written about in the Oppenheimer alternative, would history have changed if anything had changed?
So it's a very interesting question, you know, because we have survived 75 years now since the last time and the only time that atomic weapons were ever used.
And it was us. And it was us.
And it was us, the Allies, the United States in particular, that used them. Would things have been different? You know, how would you define different? We ended up, it would have been nice if they'd never been used at all, but the fact, some have argued, and some argue quite vociferously, Edward Teller being one, that they had to be used at least once to show the world how deadly they were, in the same way that we sort of gave up on chemical warfare and gave up on landmines. Most of the damage being caused by landmines is landmines left over from previous conflicts. The nations, the civilized nations of the world, come together and say, that's off the table. Yeah, we're still going to fight wars because we're human beings. We do that. But that particular atrocity is off the table. As long as it's not rogue states in possession of nuclear weapons, we've managed to be able to maintain the peace, whether it's out of moral repugnance at ever using them again, or whether it's just out of that Cold War idea of MAD, mutually assured destruction. Yeah, you know, you can bomb me, but not fast enough to keep me from retaliating before I'm destroyed. Whatever the answer is, we've had a peace for 75 years. So would things have been different if we had not ever dropped the atomic bombs? There are those, I'm not one, I tend to think that dropping them was a mistake, but there are certainly those political scientists who would argue, yeah, they would have been used during the Cuban Missile Crisis. They would have been used during the 1960s, and they would have been used in an all-out exchange that would have been much, much worse, because mutually assured destruction wouldn't have had a model. There wouldn't have been any proof to look at of how devastating it was to human beings.
How did the Soviet Union move so quickly into getting that?
They stole it. It's as simple as that. There were spies at Los Alamos, the most famous of whom was Claus Fuchs, but there were other spies as well. Truman honestly believed that he could use the atomic bombs in World War II with impunity. He felt that the Soviets simply did not have the science and technology know-how or wherewithal to make atomic weapons on their own. Well, and that was actually probably true. They did not. But they certainly were very good at espionage. They stole 100% the atomic and then ultimately the hydrogen, the fusion bomb, more powerful bomb, secrets from the Americans.
How did the Soviets go from being our allies going after Hitler to being the corruptible enemy after World War II?
And it was really clear even during World War II that it was a very uneasy alliance. Remember I said that the three parties that knew about the development of the atomic bomb before it were was used, the United States, which had the best scientists, Great Britain, mm-hmm. which had gotten the ball rolling, and Canada, which had the uranium. And also some very, very fine scientists, I will add, out of a little bit of patriotism on my part.
I love our Canadian neighbors.
For sure, for sure. But we excluded, we did not tell the Soviets. And in fact, Oppenheimer's downfall was because he was approached by his best friend, a man named Hakan Chevalier, despite the very fancy French name, was actually born in New Jersey and was a professor of French literature at the University of California, Berkeley. He approached Oppie during the Manhattan Project and said, you know, those are our pals, the Soviets, they're taking a beating. Their boys are dying in great number as they push in on Germany. They're having way more casualties, which is true, than America mm-hmm. was having during World War II. Don't we owe it to them to let them in on whatever secret it is that you're working on, Oppie? And Oppie, of course, didn't agree at all with doing that.
He was right.
He was right not to let them know. He was right not to let them know. But he didn't keep his mouth completely shut. He implicated himself and Chevalier, and that's what led to the stripping of his security clearance.
Interesting. 1957, I'm 7 years old, and I see the terror on my folks' face when the Soviets launched Sputnik, the first right. little satellite into space. Did they use the German manpower that they got from their Operation Paperclip after the war to get up into space before we did?
So they certainly wanted all of the scientists. We got the best. There's no question. Wernher von Braun, who was ultimately the head of the Saturn V, project for NASA.
Yeah, he got us to the moon.
He got us to the moon. And if von Braun and his rocketeers, the people who developed the V-2 rocket, surrendered to the Americans, actually is von Braun's brother, Magnus, who rode a bicycle down a mountain, found the nearest American soldier and said, you don't know who I am, but my brother invented the V-2 rocket and we want to surrender. Because Hitler had just killed himself, and they knew the war, you know, they were going to either be hung as war criminals or they could broker a deal.
We think he killed himself, right?
Well, that's true. That's true, yeah. Yes. But certainly von Braun was acting on the assumption that the reports on the radio coming out of Berlin were true, that the Führer was dead and that the Fatherland was going to fall. And he wanted the best possible deal. Now, the Soviets certainly got some German rocket scientists and some German intelligence. But it really was that wake-up call, because Truman and the entire post-war period had believed, based on the great success of the Manhattan Project, that there was no scientific or technological power anywhere near the equal, let alone surpassing, the American ingenuity in the world. And then when the Soviets did something, and remember, they only did it a few weeks in advance of the Americans putting up their first satellite, but those weeks made all the difference.
Well, we're coming up on 51 years since we landed on the moon with Apollo 11, and still no one else has been able to accomplish what we did a half a century ago.
I mean, you know, I have
it's amazing.
A tiny little bit of sympathy, George, for at least young moon landing deniers. I mean, I absolutely believe we went to the moon, we landed there, and that the NASA record is accurate of what was found. But you tell somebody today who has in their pocket more computing power than all of NASA had in every one of its facilities 51 years ago, that we managed to go to the moon, which is 250,000 miles away, back in the 1960s, when nobody has gone since 1972, Apollo 17, the last human landing on the moon, nobody has gone more than 500 miles away from Earth, straight up.
That's true.
You know, I mean, of course, how does that make any sense at all that we could do that and somehow lost the technology? And now we're desperately struggling to try and reinvent, literally reinvent the space wheel, literally figure out how we did it the first time.
And of course, we got off the moon because Buzz Aldrin used his Bic pen to push a little button because they couldn't fit their gloves in to do it.
That's right. I mean, it was spit wire and you know, string. I mean, the technology was incredibly primitive by our standards today, but it worked.
Let's see, Buzz is still alive, Neil is dead. What about Michael Collins?
Michael Collins is still alive.
He's still alive, too. Yeah. Two out of three for that amazing feat is pretty good.
Yeah, you know, and it was in some ways, it was a very significant gesture that they chose Armstrong to set foot on the moon first, because he was a civilian.
He was the civilian, that's
and
right.
He wanted to send that message to the world that it wasn't a military taking of fresh territory. It was a civilian, whereas Buzz Aldrin was a military man. And it is unfortunate, though, because despite the fact that Armstrong was a civilian, he was not a very public person.
No, he did not like talking to the public at all.
And so the public lost interest. 2.5 years after Apollo 11, the public was bored silly.
They should have insisted that he be a little more vocal and go on talk shows and everything else.
That's right. He should have been the goodwill ambassador. So you talk about alternate history. Set aside my one in my novel, The Oppenheimer Alternative. There's an alternate history where Buzz Aldrin was the first man on the moon and had kept up the excitement amongst the American people, and we had landed men and women on Mars, say, in 1985, instead of still now contemplating maybe being able to do it this century.
Michael Collins will be 90 on Halloween this year.
That's right. Absolutely.
Let's take some calls. Let's go to Mark in Baltimore, Maryland, to get us started. Go ahead, Mark.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Thank you.
And like George, I don't believe in coincidences. And so my question was this: could or would or might there be any connection being made to, since we know that UFOs were always interested in buzzing around military bases and all that, and the UFO crash at Roswell happened shortly after the atomic bombs were dropped, and we all know that the Enola Gay did indeed take flight from RAAF, the Roswell Army Airfield, and that was the same airfield mm-hmm. that was dispatched out to the crash site in Corona. So in Corona, New Mexico, about 12 miles, I think, northwest of Roswell. But would you wager to say that there might be any connection whatsoever to these two events?
What do you think, Robert? You're the sci-fi expert.
Yeah, you ask a very good question. When I was trying to figure out what secret history I was going to tell, about what might have been going on, you know, in the gaps in our public historical record. Of course, it occurred to me that Oppenheimer's lab was in New Mexico, Roswell was in New Mexico, that there was certainly very serious, as we know, Project Blue Book, very serious interest by the United States government in whether or not extraterrestrial craft were visiting Earth at that time. And the reason I abandoned that plot line for my own novel is because there's actually, and here I'm going to plug somebody else's book, and I don't know the gentleman at all, but there's a book, and it's a self-published book, and it's a slim little volume, but he does as good a job as anybody could do of marshaling the evidence that Oppenheimer might, in fact, indeed, it's almost inconceivable to think that Oppenheimer wasn't summoned to Roswell, right, when they wanted
to
do an investigation. He was the top physicist in the United States. He had the ultimate Q level, which was the highest level security clearance, meaning even, as I say, even Vice President Truman didn't have a Q level, which is knowing about even atomic and nuclear secrets. The book is called UFO Secrecy and the Fall of J. Robert Oppenheimer. The author's name is Donald Burleson. But just put in UFO and Oppenheimer into Amazon, and you'll find that book. I bought it. I read it. And knowing a great deal about Oppenheimer, I did enormous research for my novel, The Oppenheimer Alternative. I couldn't find anywhere where Burleson had, shaded the truth or stretched things to make his point. So absolutely, I suspect that the Oppenheimer probably was one of the many people who were involved in whatever the Roswell incident was.
Isn't it fascinating to go back historically, dig up this information, and put it into perspective, Robert? It's really fascinating.
It absolutely is, and perspective is the right word. We're talking in the 75th anniversary year of the conclusion of the Manhattan Project with the development of atomic bombs. And we now do have a little bit of perspective in two very important ways. One way is any old grudges, any old personal animosities, they're all gone. Everybody's dead. So we're now just looking at the facts. We're not saying, did Edward Teller betray Robert Oppenheimer? Had Oppie done him wrong first? Blah, blah, blah. Who cares about any of that interpersonal stuff? We care about the issues and the facts. And the second thing is, of course, I mentioned Oppenheimer had the highest security clearance available, Q, meaning that he was privy to even the secrets of atomic weapons, which only a tiny fraction of the people even working for Oppenheimer knew what they were actually working on at Los Alamos.
And then they took it away from him.
But in the 75 years since, thanks to a lot of really good historians and journalists constantly bugging the U.S. archives and the National Library and so forth, things have been declassified slowly but surely. So we have records now that I, as just a citizen, being curious, was able to access here in the 75th anniversary year that many of the people who had a really good look at this 25 years ago for the 50th anniversary year were denied access to. We have almost everything is not classified anymore because the secrets simply aren't military secrets of any value any longer.
Robert, we're going to take a break. We'll come back in a moment and wrap things up with final calls on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, Stephen Williams joins us from the Memphis Ghost Investigations and Spirit Rescue Team, so get ready for that. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you along with Robert Sawyer. And Robert, I have to congratulate you on your first time appearance. You are doing a phenomenal job.
Well, thank you so much. I'm just so thrilled to be here.
You love your subject matter. You're bubbly. You're excitable. You're perfect.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that.
Arthur C. Clarke, why was he as good as he was?
So Clarke was fascinating to me. He was my all-time favorite science fiction writer because he was the first guy really to show that you could write hard, rigorous, science-based science fiction that also dealt with metaphysical questions. Some of his best-known short stories are in that vein. The 9 Billion Names of God, which is a story about why did God create the universe as a science fiction story. The Star, which is a story about discovering the remnants of the star that had gone supernova to herald Christ's birth 2,000 years previously from our, you know, in our timeline. Childhood's End, his novel about satanic beings who might in fact be fulfilling the role of great protectors as opposed to great enemies, and the wonderful metaphysical ambiguity of 2001, A Space Odyssey. And yet everything he did, he was a serious astronomer. He worked for the RAF, the British Air Force, in World War II on the development of radar. He was absolutely rigorous, and yet he was still constantly asking, but what does it all mean? What's it about? What's the reason for this? Unbelievably intoxicating stuff to read.
We were friends with the late Jerry Pournelle.
Oh, me too. Jerry and I were both judges for the Writers of the Future
contest. How cool.
And, as you say, the late Jerry Pournelle. Jerry died, I guess it's only been about a year now, isn't it?
2017, 3 years.
Really, time flies. Yeah. You know, and Jerry, I tell you, this is the great thing about the science fiction community, George, because Jerry and I could not be more opposite politically. Didn't matter. You could sit down and have a civil conversation with conflicting points of view about ideas and enjoy a friendly meal and a cordial drink.
Yep.
And, you know, that's the beauty of the literature of ideas. It's not the literature of what do you, you know, dyed in the wool and never change your mind about. It's the literature of what do you want to be questioned about.
And did you know Larry Niven?
Larry's still with us. Larry is also a judge for the Writers of the Future contest.
Small world.
I'll just say to any aspiring writer out there, please check out our website, writersofthefuture.com. It's a free-to-enter science fiction and fantasy short story writing contest judged by me and Larry Niven, Gregory Benford, Nancy Kress, Nnedi Okorafor, the biggest name, Brandon Sanderson, the biggest names in science fiction and fantasy are the judges.
Well, now, do you know Mark Zakrie by any chance?
Mark Scott Zakrie, my pal, yes, of course.
My God, all our buddies.
You know, it's a small world. It really is, you know, George. What's astonishing is that you and I are meeting for the first time tonight because it is such a small, it's a big planet, and there are 7-point-something billion of us. But those of us who are interested deeply in science fiction and space and the unknown, that's a small community.
Let's go to Dale, truck driving in Maryland. Hey, Dale, welcome to the program.
Hey, George, great to talk to you again. My beautiful wife and I are coast-to-coast insiders, and we just love your show. We listen to 2 or 3 a day.
Thank you.
About 10 years ago, I spoke to you, and you had a psychic on. He told me I was going for a surgery within a year, and he saved my life. I did.
Oh, perfect.
I have a question for your guest there.
Sure.
And then I have a 10-second comment for you, George.
Okay.
What if they drop the bombs on unpopulated areas and just as a show of force and say, look, this is what we have. This is what it will cause. We'll drop them on all your cities if you don't surrender. Why couldn't they have done something like that instead of bombing Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
Excellent question. And Leo Szilard, who I mentioned earlier, was a scientist, a physicist involved with the Manhattan Project, and he circulated a petition amongst the scientists, starting in Chicago. He was at the facility at the University of Chicago, advocating precisely that. Look, why don't we do it in a remote area? Invite Japanese scientists to come and observe.
Show them how it works.
Have a look. Report back. Do any test you want. Satisfy yourselves completely. And the bottom line is General Groves, the military head of the Manhattan Project, classified Szilard's petition as top secret, meaning he could no longer circulate it. Groves said to Oppenheimer 75 years ago this month at the Trinity test, when Oppie said, well, now the war is over. And Groves said, yes, as soon as we drop 2 bombs on Japan. He didn't say 1 bomb. He said 2 bombs. Why? Because ultimately Groves's goal may not have been the official American goal, but he was the head of the project. It was certainly his goal, was to test the 2 competing designs, the Fat Man design, which was revolutionary, and the Little Boy design, which was fairly straightforward physics, and see what damage they could do to actual cities. He felt the United States military needed that information. And Oppenheimer was with them up until the first dropping on Hiroshima. And they thought, okay, it's over. We don't. And then they went and just 72 hours later did the second bomb. Why did they do the second bomb just 3 days later? When, remember, there's no radio, there's no television. The telegraph and phone lines are down. The railway lines are wrecked. Word is just reaching Tokyo that this unknown weapon has devastated Hiroshima, and they drop the next bomb. Why? Because the meteorologist said the whole coming week is going to be shot due to thunderstorms. Mm-hmm. Can't fly in them. Either you do it now or you wait a week. And Groves knew if he waited a week, the Japanese would surrender. So there was this really heinous motivation to really test it. And a handful of cities had been spared the firebombing. Tokyo had been firebombed.
They were next.
That's right. Okura was supposed to be the second target, and it was only because it was overcast with those in-rolling thunderstorms that they went to Nagasaki instead. But absolutely, it should have been. I think most people in retrospect say exactly what you said, my friend who just called. Why didn't we just show them what we've got without killing anybody?
And let's go back to Dale for final statement. Go ahead, Dale.
Yes, sir. Superb knowledge on the subject. George, I've been trying to get in touch with you about these chips and people's the implants that they're talking about. That is just an opening for all kinds of craziness. They could put chips in people that electrocute them when they want them to stop doing stuff because there's all this 5G. Everybody's going to be on camera. Everybody's going to know what everybody's doing. I mean, they can use them as assassins, put them in their heads and, you know, get them close to certain people and just detonate them. That chip thing is crazy. We need to riot like these people are riding over to COVID when that stuff comes around to make sure that we don't get them in people's heads, because that is a dangerous thing that they're trying to do. And it's been awesome talking to you again, George. You have a great year.
Thanks, Dale. You too. I'm not going to get chipped. How about you, Robert?
You know, the only chip I want is some residual brain capacity as I get older. I saw my dad, who died in his 90s, started to lose his memory. And I think by the time I get up to that age, we are going to have benign sorts of implants that people will get that will, you know, give you cognitive facilities that will certainly enhance your functioning. We already have some implants, you know, to help people with Parkinson's disease, for instance. So I'm not necessarily against becoming a little bit cyborg, a little bit of a cybernetic organism, but absolutely you've got to know what's being put into you, who's putting it in, and what the agenda is. We all thought, you know, that Facebook was all free, right? And then it turns out, of course, yeah, it's free because we're harvesting enormous amounts of information about how you as an individual behave and selling it to the highest bidder. So there's a place for this paranoia about what technology is going to do to us.
Thomas in La Jolla. Go ahead, Thomas. Take it away.
George, thank you for accepting my call. Robert, great information. I wanted to discuss another author. She was a Russian expatriate from the Soviet Revolution, the Bolshevik Revolution. Her name was Ayn Rand.
Of course, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Atlas Shrugged, right?
Yeah, Atlas Shrugged. Her first name, A-Y-N Rand, R-A-N-D. Now, after World War II, Ayn Rand was given an assignment by Random House to interview everybody who was anybody in the Manhattan Project, in the Los Alamos complex, etc. It took her over 2 years to assemble all of the interviews, including a very extensive interview with J. Robert Oppenheimer. And when it came to be published by Random House, the National Security Establishment reviewed the manuscript and they said absolutely not. And they wanted her to sign a non-disclosure agreement. She refused to sign it, the NDA, but she said, look, I'm a good patriot. I won't release the interviews. though she was bitter because she spent over 2 years interviewing every scientist, everybody, Oppenheimer, Feynman, you name it, Leslie Groves. And then she wrote a novella called Top Secret. And same thing happened. She was denied publishing of the novella Top Secret, which was about a fictional history of the Los Alamos Project. Okay, so Ayn Rand was clever. She wrote Atlas Shrugged. And if you remember Atlas Shrugged, its hero, its protagonist, was a physicist named John Galt.
That's right. Who is John Galt?
Who is John Galt? And Ayn Rand said in essays subsequent to Atlas Shrugged that she based the persona of John Galt on J. Robert Oppenheimer. Now, Atlas Shrugged, in my opinion, is in the best tradition of H.G. Wells. It's science fiction, but the overlay is a sociological commentary. And she incorporated everything that she learned from these Los Alamos scientists. And she wrote about this in her essays, that the scientists discussed not just the making of a bomb, they discussed directed energy weapons. They discussed free energy technology, you know, they discussed Tesla technology, extracting energy from the atmosphere, etc. But she was denied publishing that in her interviews, which she spent 2 long years, you know, assembling those interviews. So what she did was she wrote Atlas Shrugged. She based John Galt on Oppenheimer. She stripped the left-wing idealism from the Oppenheimer persona of John Galt. And she incorporated, if you remember the novel, Atlas Shrugged, she incorporated directed energy weapons, you know, Tesla technology, extraction of energy from the atmosphere, free energy technology, nanotechnology, you know, et cetera. And I've always been curious about this. It's a, you know, she did not sign a non-disclosure agreement, but she agreed with the national security establishment reluctantly not to publish her Los Alamos interviews.
But she kind of hit it. We only got a few minutes left here. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, I mean, actually, I would say that the closer parallel in Atlas Shrugged is to the character of Robert Stadler, who even has the same first name as Oppenheimer. But there's no question that certainly, whether you want to argue for John Galt or you want to argue for Robert Stadler, that Ayn Rand absolutely did interview Robert Oppenheimer and did not publish the interviews. There's a phrase we English literature types use. It's French, roman éclat, which means a novel with a key. And if you know what the key is, you can decode who's really being spoken about. And what the caller has done here is exactly right. You look at Atlas Shrugged, and there's no question that you're supposed to connect the dots between the quote-unquote fictitious characters in the novel and the real-life figures that either Ayn Rand wanted to satirize or wanted to lionize in her work.
And what do you recommend for those prospective science fiction writers, Robert?
The Writers of the Future contest. I got my own start by entering the contest way back in the 80s. Didn't win, got honorable mentions, but got some really good feedback. Not a penny to enter the contest. WritersOfTheFuture.com has all the rules.
Oh, you got that right. And I want to thank you for being on the program. Keep in touch with us. What's your next work?
I'm just starting a work now about essentially what life is going to be like post-COVID-19. It's going to be a different world
boy.
Than the one we know.
Are you convinced it was made in a lab?
I am not convinced.
I'll pull you that way.
I've got an open mind here, but it is definitely suspicious that the high-level containment biological laboratory in Wuhan is walking distance.
You got it. And we gave them a grant. We gave them a grant. Robert, thank you so much. Up next, let's talk a little bit about ghost investigations on Coast to Coast AM.